We're exploring more than a century of Wisconsin beer making and what this legacy means today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent on this Labor Day. More than 100 years ago, most towns in Wisconsin had a city brewery. German immigrants built breweries all across the state. And since the first commercial brewery was established in 1835, Wisconsin has seen more than 800 open and hundreds close. So what do you want to know about your favorite local brewery and how it got started? What are you curious about as the brewing industry took hold here in Wisconsin? Is your family part of this heritage? Join in at 800-642-1234. Doug Hoverson has written two comprehensive histories on brewing. The first is called Land of Amber Waters. It chronicles Minnesota's brewing history. His new book moves one state to the east. It's called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State. It weighs in at about 6 pounds, is more than 700 pages of meticulous brewing history, lots of pictures, memorabilia. Doug, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, Kate.
So before we get into Wisconsin history, you've written the definitive history on Minnesota brewing and Wisconsin brewing. Do our neighbors to the east have a similar trajectory in how the brewing industry evolved?
Well, I think most of the upper Midwest states were very similar, that in that we have the German immigrants who were flooding into the country just as a lot of this land was becoming available. And you also have some aspects of the Industrial Revolution happening too. So you've got trains that can start moving the goods around, roads and canals are better. And so this entire upper Midwest, really from Ohio to Missouri to Minnesota, shows some similarities.
Were there key investors who worked cross borders in the Midwest that really helped get brewing started across the Midwest?
I think what you find really is more that individual people moved. So many of these businesses were just simple family businesses for a generation or so, that any investment they had was maybe going to the local bank or a rich local farmer to get a little bit of financial help.
When you were first exposed to the beers of Wisconsin, what grabbed your attention? What was your first memory of Wisconsin beer?
I think that probably goes back to my college age, and I'm going to stick with that story. And for a Minnesota boy, the Wisconsin beers were generally that hard-to-get forbidden fruit, and being able to get some Point Special was really rare. I think Point may have had an impact too, because I had a friend who was a beer can collector before I really started drinking beer, and those bright blue Point cans really grabbed your eye.
And I understand you were crossing the border because you could buy it at a younger age in Wisconsin than where you were. Is that right?
That's right. I didn't do that all that frequently. I did that mostly when I was traveling back and forth to the University of Michigan, but it was still well worth a trip. And at that point, again, for a Minnesota boy, the idea you could buy beer, good beer, in a gas station was a little bit unusual.
We're talking with Doug Hoverson. He's author of the book, The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. Beer lovers, what questions do you have about the brewing industry in Wisconsin? What do you want to know? What's your favorite brewery here? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Doug, through the hour, we're going to be hearing some jingles. What were some of the beer ads that have stuck out to you through the years, and how advertising was a pretty big element for beer?
Advertising was critical going all the way back to the 1870s, and that's really when Pabst and Schlitz and Blatt started to make their big national reputation. And then after World War II, radio and television really started to make them national brands, and especially those great TV ads where you've got a nice cold beer pouring into a crystal clear glass with a catchy jingle like, what'll you have? Pabst Blue Ribbon, or I'm from Milwaukee, and all of those great songs that have just stayed with us and people of a certain age can still break out singing them.
By the 70s, the national breweries included more people of color in their ads. What was the intent when Miller's and other showed African Americans in their ads?
Well, I think they were adapting to a couple of things there. One of them was the influence of the civil rights movement, which made the communities of color much more visible as a separate identifiable group. And recognizing that among the brewers, the competition for those markets, which was beginning to have more disposable income, was something that was worth pursuing.
And women as well were in these ads as the feminist movement evolved.
And that's kind of interesting because women had been used in beer marketing going back again to the 1870s or 80s, though at first it was simply using attractive women to market to men. But by about the 1890s, when beer started to move into the home, some of the marketing was actually being done with the idea that women were going to be buying the beer. And so the portrayals of women became much more, well, you know, much less provocative and much more affirming.
Well, take us way back to the beginning. How did beer get established in Wisconsin? It is the mid-1800s. What's going on?
Probably the most important thing for this was the lead mining industry in southwestern Wisconsin. It's probably a surprise to some people that the first breweries were not in Milwaukee, but actually down in the lead district in Mineral Point was, in fact, the first one. And that was really designed to serve all those thirsty Welsh miners who really didn't want to be without their ale and for whom shipping it in from someplace else was going to be far too expensive.
So tell us a little bit about how unions factored in to brewing. And were there strong unions in the early days?
In the very earliest breweries, there wasn't much need for unions because it was simply the proprietor and maybe a son or a cousin. But in the post-Civil War period, as the brewers started to get more specialized and they started to ship more, the workforce got much larger. So at that point, the growth of the unions in brewing really reflected the growth of unions in many other industries as well. The Knights of Labor were a major player from the 1870s through the 1880s. The AFL took over in the 1880s. And there were some major strikes involving the breweries going all the way back to the 1880s and then up through the 1960s and 70s.
How were wages and work hours?
In general, the wages were better than a similarly skilled worker could get in almost any other business. The hours, however, were brutal. Typically, you had to be up very early in the morning, and sometimes the workday would start at 4 or 5 in the morning. Sometimes the brew process would be a little bit unpredictable, and you might have to work longer. The cleanup had to be done that day. So it was not at all uncommon for 14-hour days in the brew house.
We're in a tour through Wisconsin beer history with Doug Hoverson as our guide. His new book is called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, and it's a comprehensive overview of our state's breweries. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you collect beer memorabilia? Why should we remember the evolution of brewing in Wisconsin? We'll be back in just a moment. More beer history on the Ideas Network.
Miller stands clear. Beer after beer, if you've got the time, you've got the time, we've got the beer.
We're on a tour of Wisconsin breweries over a century in the making. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Along the way, there's the story of Schlitz, which in the 1960s tried to save money by using cheaper ingredients, and then the ad campaigns that hurt the brand more.
There is just one Schlitz, yeah, yeah, nothing else comes near. When you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer.
Do you remember beer jingles or old ad campaigns? How did they go? Do you collect beer memorabilia? Do you save cans or signs? Where do you display your collection? Perhaps you travel across the state, visiting different breweries. Where do you go? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Doug Hoverson, his new book is called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, and he stays with us on this brewing history road trip. Doug, how did breweries influence the development of road and rail and expanded transportation routes?
Beer is pretty heavy, as anybody who's tried to carry a keg around knows. And as a consequence, the roads just plain had to be better to handle first the brewery wagons and then the much heavier brewery trucks. So the breweries definitely had an investment in creating some of the early plank roads. They had an interest in making sure docking facilities on the lake were up to their standards. And then also, of course, the railroads, when they couldn't put their brewery near the railroad itself, they would often get a specific link into their brewery yard so they could ship the beer out much more easily.
So did the infrastructure improvements really lean on benefiting breweries more than the people who lived in the community?
I'm not sure we could really go that far.
Okay.
But I think that along with the other industries, especially in Milwaukee, where there was heavy work to be done, the railroad companies and the city councils were definitely interested in making sure that the breweries had what they needed in order to be successful.
And you need hops to make beer, and the hop trade apparently in Wisconsin grew up here with the breweries. In the 1860s, hop farmers in Sauk County were earning more than $1,000 an acre. Why was the market for hops so hot?
Part of that was because the post-Civil War brewing boom, where a lot of people came back from the war, started the business. Again, there was more disposable income, and breweries were moving west. So there was a lot of demand for hops. The Wisconsin hops were of good quality, and you had these incredible hop harvest scenes with thousands of young women being brought in on trains to the hop districts and swarming the areas and having to pick the hops extremely quickly because there's only a very limited window in which they're at their flavor and aroma peak.
And this is labor intensive.
Very labor intensive. Up until very, very recently, there were no mechanical hop pickers that were of any use. So it was simply a matter of picking each little hop cone off the vines, and the vines themselves had to be brought down because they couldn't grow up to 20 feet tall.
We're talking with Doug Hoverson. The book is The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. There's a line for you. What is your favorite brewery in Wisconsin? Does it have specialty or craft beer? Where is it and what makes it special? Join in at 800-642-1234. Doug, Miller is one of three American breweries that grew up from a family business in the 1800s and survived Prohibition. Take us to the dry years as businesses are banned from the manufacturing and sale of alcohol. How did that affect Wisconsin?
Wisconsin had a really interesting heritage during the Prohibition era because whereas several other states decided that the bootleg liquor of choice was going to be spirits, a lot of Wisconsin was still interested in having beer. It wasn't so much bang for the buck as the flavor of beer. So there was a lot of making near beer, which could then be spiked with alcohol. Some of them omitted the de-alcoholizing step, which came last, so real beer got produced. But a lot of them shifted into other businesses. They either took advantage of retail connections they already had to distribute candy or soda pop. They had sometimes converted to entirely different businesses, like Pabst, for example, had a lock factory in part of their brewery, and It's believed that some of the locks ended up being used to lock up saloons that had violated prohibition.
What was the process like to take the alcohol out of beer and then substitute it for the real thing, this near beer?
So in order to make near beer, you have to make regular beer first. And then there is a process, the de-alcoholizing process is kind of like a reverse distilling process where the alcohol is removed and the rest of it remains. So it really is just a matter of sending it through one more tank and having one more machine work on it.
So let's look at speakeasies. I was fascinated in your book in La Crosse, there were this series of tunnels leading to a trap door and this whole brewing facility supplying to gangsters. How did the speakeasies come about?
In a lot of cases, it was simply an existing business that decided to continue on with the help of local authorities. Though there were also some other ones, and not all of these made the book because, as you noticed, it's pretty heavy already. But there were cases where local parishes would be serving alcohol in the church basement. Or there would be situations where an office building would have something, again, in the basement. So it was a wide variety of circumstances. And of course, some private residences also converted themselves into places where alcohol was served.
Were some of them as elaborate as what was going on in La Crosse to have a whole brewing facility underground?
I think that La Crosse one was probably an outlier because there were tunnels leading to several buildings, and they had a brewing setup there that was equivalent to some of the craft brewers of today, some of the bigger ones. And I think that was an outlier, but there were some of the defunct breweries at the time that just simply kept using their equipment, either under the original management or somebody who took over the brewery.
So Prohibition didn't end until 1933. How did Wisconsin move past these dry years? Can you paint a picture for us?
Wisconsin was ready to move out of Prohibition almost immediately. Luckily, many of the brewing families were in a good enough financial position where they had enough money to start rehabbing the buildings and buying new equipment almost immediately. And of course, Wisconsin's tavern culture provided a ready market for the brewers who were able to get going again.
Were brewers concerned at all that Prohibition could happen again, that this could reoccur?
I think their only real concern was right at the beginning of World War II, because during World War I, there were a lot of military restrictions, but the culture was different at that point, and I think the problems of Prohibition were very fresh in the public's mind, and ultimately, there was a court case in 1945 which declared that beer was in fact essential to civilian morale and that a strike at a brewery in St. Paul was in fact an illegal strike because it hurt the war effort.
How important were breweries to local communities? Because you had mentioned that, hundreds breweries got started, but hundreds also closed.
The breweries were essential for generations, and they were most important in the 19th century, especially in the rural areas, as a market for the local grain or the local hops. The farmers were encouraged to bring their grain in, and they advertised that they would be paid Milwaukee prices or the highest market prices. As the breweries became more industrialized, it was usually one of the bigger employers in the town, and a lot of the other businesses that they did help this as well. They brought business into the train station. They were often a big purchaser of municipal water as city water supplies get going, and the general trade that those employees brought in. The Berlin Brewery, in fact, once paid its workers in $2 bills in the 1950s, and they had an experiment just to see how quickly and how far those $2 bills spread throughout the commerce of the local community.
While they were doing their own science experiment there, a social science experiment. We are learning about Wisconsin's pioneering beer brewing heritage that extends way back to the mid-19th century, and still we see it strong today. Doug Hoverson's book is The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, and he stays with us through the hour. Do you own a brewery or work in one? What's it like making beer? What is something people don't know about your profession or about the brewing heritage? Maybe you bartend. What are the most popular beers you sell? Join in at 800-642-1234. When we come back, we'll look at the connection between beer and baseball. That's right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
When you say Budweiser, you've said it all. There is no other one. There's only something less. Because the king of beers is leading all the rest. When you say Budweiser,
you've said it all.
We're on a tour of Wisconsin brewing history on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pabst Brewing Company created a brewing empire founded in 1844 in Milwaukee. Frederick Pabst was known as Captain Pabst, and in the early 1900s, they advertised almost exclusively in newspapers and magazines. Pabst positioned his beer as a luxury product that was worth spending money to enjoy. Fast forward to 1979, and the Pabst Blue Ribbon targets the working class. What questions do you have about brewing in Wisconsin and how it evolved? What's your favorite brewery? Does it have specialty beers or craft beer? Join in with your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. The book is called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State, and author Doug Hoverson brings us an extensive history and how it grew up here. Doug, let's look at the connection between beer and sports teams. There was the semi-professional baseball team, the Kurth Brewers, that was, they were popular prior to Prohibition, and they even fielded an African-American player during the early 1900s. How did breweries come to sponsor sports teams?
I think that was just a natural outgrowth of the community in a lot of ways, because those earliest teams were mostly brewery employees with the occasional ringer. But I think that as the sporting culture grew and spectators became much more common at the events and were interested in having a beer, the link there just became obvious. And pretty soon the breweries were supporting baseball teams and bowling teams, softball teams, depending on the city. There were basketball teams and even an occasional hockey team. I think probably my favorite basketball team was the Rhinelander Shorties, which doesn't seem like the best basketball team, but they were a very good team.
And Farmers Brewing Company made a near beer called Old Favorite. The label depicts vigorous outdoor activities, including baseball. Were breweries attaching themselves to a sporting lifestyle early on?
Well, they were definitely presenting themselves as a drink of moderation, a drink of refreshment, a drink of the outdoors, something that refined people would have after their recreation. So that label you mentioned was really based on some of the old baseball cards of the pre-World War I era. And as with the tobacco companies that made those baseball cards, they were trying to link to anything that gave an impression of enjoyment.
Well, then, you know, there's the Milwaukee Brewers. How did the baseball team receive the identity of being the Brewers? Is there a story there?
There's mostly the obvious thing that what else would this team be?
Yeah.
You know, there was an earlier Milwaukee Brewers that was ultimately replaced by the Milwaukee Braves when they moved in from Boston. And that was largely at the behest of Frederick Miller, who wanted to make Milwaukee a real destination for sports. So the idea when the Braves moved to Atlanta and the Seattle Pilots eventually came to Milwaukee, it seemed like a natural.
Well, let's take a call now. Mark joining us from Wapaka. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, my question is he mentioned the hops farming earlier in bringing in all the laborers to work on the hops farm. I was wondering how much of the hops farming remains in Wisconsin. It's like I've seen some hobbyists put up some poles and grow some hops and things like that, but a true farming industry in Wisconsin, is that still a thing, or is it other parts of the country that grow it now or import it? Just curious about that.
Thanks, Mark. Doug, what do we know about hops today?
Well, of course, the Pacific Northwest is the most famous hop-growing region in the country, but Wisconsin's industry has really started to go beyond the hobbyists in the last few years and start to become real agribusiness again. There are a number of prominent hops farms. Gorst Valley is one of them. There is a consortium of brewers that specifically set up contracts with Wisconsin hop farmers in order to encourage their business. And it gives the brewers a chance to work with the growers and get the particular varieties of hops that they want for the types of beer that they're making.
So looking at the standout leaders of the beer industry, there's Miller, there's also Schlitz and Pabst and Heilemann. What made these companies so successful? Did they have a formula?
They had a really great mix of consistent quality and spectacular advertising, as we've heard with some of these ads that have been coming up throughout the show. I had totally forgotten about that Disco Pabst ad.
But it worked?
They created a tremendous image for the product, and they really also created that idea that there was a certain thing that beer was supposed to taste like and that their products tasted like that. Especially in the 70s, there's really no choice other than a lager, you know, a American premium lager or a light American premium lager.
I understand that Schlitz tried to cut corners on the brewing process. How did that go for Schlitz?
Not particularly well. And what they were trying to do at that point was to get more beer out of their existing breweries without having to build another new expensive brewery. So they sped up the fermentation process a little bit, which might have worked out okay, but they also were changing one of the additives that stabilized the beer at the same time. And it turned out to be a combination that led to kind of a snowy precipitant coming out of the bottle. So if you shook a bottle of it, it kind of looked like a snow globe. So there wasn't anything harmful in the beer. The taste was still pretty much the same. But for people who were really expecting to just pour a nice golden clear glass of beer, it definitely looked like there was something wrong with it, and millions of bottles ended up having to be destroyed.
Another standout name is Leinenkugel Beer, and it just celebrated its 150th year after being founded in Chippewa Falls. How did Leinenkugel emerge among the breweries?
Well, it's really interesting to track some of those breweries who somehow survived the contraction period and came out the other side successfully. And often it seems like the secret sauce there was just competent family management, which meant they didn't overexpand before they really had it. A quality beer and sometimes a good seasonal product like a Bock beer. And Leinenkugel's was really smart about marketing their Bock beer in markets like the Twin Cities to make sure that people knew about the name, to, again, kind of create that mystique of the North Woods. And I think everything I've read just suggests it was really good management by the Leinenkugel family.
Were these brewers expanding to international markets at all, or were they staying close to home in the Midwest?
Most of them were staying close to home in the Midwest. Of course, the slogan for Point in this period was, when you're out of Point, you're out of town.
And that's Stevens Point.
Right, Stevens Point. They had about a 35-mile delivery radius. At the other time, Huber down in Monroe was actually making some moves into international markets, often with what today we would refer to as contract brewing, where they were making a beer for a particular market. So those, the four that made it through, which would have been Huber and Monroe, Lion and Kugel, Stevens Point, and Walter and Eau Claire, mostly were just taking advantage of the loyalty that Wisconsin drinkers had in their local taverns to the local beer.
We're talking with Doug Hoverson. The book is The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, and you can join in with your questions about Wisconsin's brewing history. The number is 800-642-1234. Doug, let's take a look at the rise of craft brewing. Over the decades, there's been a controversy over how we define it. What does craft mean?
According to the Brewers Association, craft means that you are using the traditional ingredients, you are using traditional processes, you are not blending batches for consistency. And one of the controversial parts is that you cannot be owned by a non-craft brewery. So there are a number of arguments. Are we talking about something that tastes like craft beer, or are we talking about the business that has to be craft?
And craft brewers have really taken off in recent years in Wisconsin. How have they been doing?
Many of them have been doing spectacularly well. And that's in terms of both growth in terms of barrels and reputation around the country and around the world. There have been numerous breweries that have won awards. Capital Brewing in Middleton won some early awards. New Glarus started to win international awards back in the 1990s. And many others have started to find their own specialty styles of beer and really lead the brewing industry in many ways.
And local communities also rally around them, is that right?
They do very much. It's, again, kind of hearkening back to the mid-19th century when a brewery tap room became one of the social centers. They're used for fundraising events. They're used for cultural events. I stopped in a tap room at one point when there were art classes going on.
Author Doug Hoverson has a new book. It is on the rise of the beer industry in Wisconsin, and it's called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. Still time for your questions about the brewing industry in Wisconsin. We're at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in a minute here on the Ideas Network.
Miller stands clear, beer after beer. If you've got the time, you've got the time, we've got the beer.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Wisconsin's rich brewing history here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 1975, Wisconsin was home to the second, third, and fourth largest breweries in America. And by the early 80s, four of the five largest brewing companies in the country were headquartered here. Do you travel around the state visiting breweries? What do you like about brewery tours? What are the most memorable ones? Do you own a brewery or work at one? Tell us about your profession in making beer. How does your family fit into Wisconsin's brewing history? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. The book is The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, and author Doug Hoverson stays with us. Doug, how often have Wisconsin breweries been owned or run by women? How do women factor into this history?
The very, very earliest breweries back in the Middle East thousands of years ago were run by women. And in Wisconsin, there's actually a pretty vigorous tradition of women either owning the brewery or working at it in some capacity. In the 19th century, there were a lot of cases where the brewer died and his wife took over the business. And many of the cases, clearly the surviving spouse, she did a great job with the brewery. Probably the most important example of that would be Johanna Heilemann taking over for Gottlieb Heilemann. And clearly her brewery continued to prosper. We have some examples where one of the Waukesha breweries was run by a woman in the post-World War II period. And during the craft era, many, many women have taken an active role. And Wisconsin has a very vigorous chapter of the Pink Boots Society, which is women who are brewery proprietors or actually head brewers and brewmasters.
Yeah, you found about 40 women were listed as principal owners of breweries at some point prior to Prohibition. Did women ever do manual labor in the brew house, or were they in the back office?
Sometimes they were in the back office, but we have a few written examples of where they were actually working in the brew house or even helping with delivery. And there were probably more examples of that, but they just weren't recorded in any way that I would have access to it.
Well, technology continues to change within the industry as different beers are introduced into production. How have we seen how beer has been produced, you know, starting in the early 1900s compared to how we make it today?
The early 1900s were really an era moving even through the 1950s when the industrial process was considered the guarantee of quality. And that was one of the reasons for brewery tours. Come in and see our gleaming equipment, come in and see our spotless floors, and you can see that our process will create great beer.
All the stainless steel, yeah.
Right, and it was just, and they were cathedrals of industry in many ways. And it was a very set process. And I think one of the things that craft brewers have today is both the access to that kind of incredible, consistent process, but also the ability to create different types of beers, where we're seeing an increase in sour beers, we're seeing an increase in unfiltered beers. And a lot of the craft brewers will do a one-off batch where they will add fruit to the barrel or the keg. They will do, you know, add additional hops at the end called dry hopping. And there's just a lot of ways that you can take a fairly standard recipe and create something really interesting with it.
Have brewers had to be more creative and resourceful in how they use their ingredients in terms of flavor?
I think they have. And one of the things that will sometimes frustrate brewers is the idea that the customer is always looking for the next big thing, the next bright, shiny object. So they have to continually innovate. And you can see, for example, IPAs with nearly any kind of fruit added to them. And I think, though, that you're also seeing a kind of a little bit of a backlash to that, where a lot of brewers are just saying, what can I do with the grain here to make the cleanest beer? And you're also seeing some interesting new grains coming in. There's some more sustainably harvestable grains that brewers are starting to use. A lot of brewers are starting to introduce a new Norwegian yeast that has just been made commercially available. So there's a lot of ways of tweaking the basic recipe and getting some interesting flavors as well.
Let's bring in Nancy now in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Yes, I just wanted to share that My grandfather, my aunt, and my father worked for Kingsbury Brewery in Sheboygan, and my aunt worked in the bottling house, and that the women could do that, but when they married, they had to then leave. And also that Kingsbury was shipping Bock beer to Saudi Arabia in the 50s when I was in high school, so I didn't hear the presenter mention that brewery. Maybe I tuned in too late.
Nancy, thanks so much. Doug, what do we know about Kingsbury Brewery?
Well, Kingsbury is a really interesting success story because they were one of the very, very few breweries anywhere that actually increased their distribution range during Prohibition. They had a very successful Kingsbury Pale, which was a near beer that was shipped all over the country. And as Nancy suggested, during the 50s, they were, in fact, shipping canned product over to Saudi Arabia. And instead of the scroll that was typically on the cans, there was a map of Saudi Arabia. Mm. And of course, that was the near beer product because the full alcohol product would not have been allowed in Saudi Arabia.
Well, let's bring in Nancy now in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. My husband's dad had a tavern up in Marathon County, and boy, I tell you, Marathon beer was the big one. I don't know if they have anything about that. And now I have a son-in-law who makes beer, and all different kinds of flavors, I guess. I don't know. I don't drink beer. But anyhow, did you have anything about the Marathon County, the Marathon Brewing up in Marathon, Wisconsin?
Thanks, Nancy. Yeah, Marathon. How did it represent?
Marathon was another really interesting story. It ends up showing up in several places in the book because it was one of those small cities that throughout the 1880s and 1890s really, really wanted to have a brewery, but nobody seemed to be willing to move there and start one. When it did get going, it was a very popular brewery in its era. It had another basketball team, and they were the Wee Willies, which is another ironic name for a basketball team. But they were very successful as a brewery, and they made it until 1967. So they were one of that last era of small town breweries to finally succumb to pressure.
Doug, where do you see the brewing industry headed in Wisconsin?
That's a really interesting question because I think in the last few years, we've seen Wisconsin's craft breweries move away from producing just the lagers that Wisconsin is most famous for and introducing sour beers and very bold IPAs. Some of the best barrel aging programs in the country are located in Wisconsin. But I think what we're going to see is this some steady growth as new cities get a brewery that really ends up being kind of an evening coffee shop. It's a gathering place for the locals. They will move into some local draft accounts, but it's going to be hard for a lot of breweries to try and move up and get into that next tier where they're in package stores all over the state or all over the region.
Doug, thank you for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. I thank you for inviting me.
Doug Hoverson's new book is called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State. You can see some of the historical illustrations from the book right now on WPR.org/mornings. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.